and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with the guest I'll welcome very shortly, we'll take a journey into the magical world of movies to explore how films can powerfully reflect real life's struggles and joys, making them so much more than just a movie. This week, it's wartime dramas that go off with a bang. Of course, war has been a topic of countless movies over the past 100 years or so. It's a natural vehicle for serious human drama. Let's visit some classics and some lesser-known gems in this genre. Coming up later, we follow soldiers on an extraordinary philosophical journey into a horrific theater of war.
I wondered how it would be when I died. What it'd be like to know that this breath now was the last one you was ever going to draw. I just hope I can meet it the same way she did. With the same calm.
One very young recruit challenges his mother's more pacifistic tendencies.
Why does that make you happy? You hate your country that much?
I love my country. It's a war I hate. It's pointless and stupid, and the sooner we have peace, the better.
Oh, the war will end. We will crush our enemies into dust. And when they are destroyed, we shall use their graves as toilets.
Okay, no more politics.
And we'll witness a homecoming that's more bittersweet than imaginable.
Wow. It's really great to be back in the neighborhood. I got it. Everything looks so different. Major!
But before we get to all that, let me introduce our guest this week. Antonella Axisa read for a Master's in Performance at Goldsmiths College, London. She also trained in Brussels and in Los Angeles, where she lived for 3 months. Antonella is a regular on Maltese TV and theatre shows. She has also appeared in numerous local and foreign film productions, and recently produced her own film short. And she joins me in the studio today. Antonella, welcome.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Lovely to have you here. Thank you for coming in, Antonella. So, I mentioned in the intro, you lived in London and Brussels before Los Angeles.
Yes, yes.
But I wanted to ask about LA because I spent many years there working in the studio
mm-hmm,
system.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of that as a city? What was LA like for you?
So, I wanted to kind of live the life of actors there. Obviously, as an actress, you kind of dream about this Hollywood thing, you know? So, I wanted to experience it and do as much as I could in the little time possible. So I went there on a tourist visa, which expires after 90 days.
Right.
So I tried to make the most of these 3 months. At
right.
the end of it, I also traveled a little bit in the US. So, and I went there on a course there in Brussels. I used to take these lessons in the Chabak technique. There is this studio called Ivana Chabak, and she's a coach for many stars in Hollywood. You know, she coached, Halle Berry in Monster, I think, and,
Tell us a bit about the technique.
Yes.
What's the sort of the focus of that?
So basically, maybe we can get to that later. But what I did there in Los Angeles was basically take these lessons. I did as much as I could, and I did profiles in all the websites as well, in the casting websites. All you can do on a tourist visa is unpaid things, though.
Yes.
So I applied for a few sort of shorts and a couple of student films, and I did a short film and a student film, and got to know a lot of people, got to know the city a little bit. At some point I was kind of trying to decide whether I wanted to move there,
mm-hmm.
but then decided otherwise, and that's a whole other story.
Yes, I mean, what did you think of, like, apart from the amazing film and sort of entertainment opportunities, what did you make of the culture, the people in LA?
So it's a weird culture. I don't know if you agree with me, Andrew, but
I've got a lot to say about
yes,
that, but you're the guest today.
We have a whole program about LA, I think. So I mean, it's like a little microcosmos. It's like its own world where everyone comes to do something to related to acting, to become famous.
Mm.
I found a lot of sort of friendly people, and I made friends with the people I attended class with. Those are the ones, obviously, you meet every day, kind of thing. So you end up
common interests.
Probably. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And most of them were also foreign, and that helps. Kind of, we were all there for a reason. You know, we were studying, trying to make the most of this experience. But then the locals, it's a weird culture, and one of the main things that I remember is kind of the difference in class. You know, you see the homeless people,
mm.
and that's really tough. You know, to see. And then you see these villas, all these people, all these very, very rich people. And, you know, all the weird things like the pet hotels, for example. And, you know, you kind of see these things in real life rather than in films. Or, you know, we hear about these in sort of gossip websites and things like that.
No, but a lot of it's true. It's a bit bonkers over there, isn't it?
It is. And like once after the... After one of the lessons we had at the Chubbuck studio, the teacher was like, "Should we go to the strip club today?"
Wow.
And I'm like, and it was like a normal thing that they did every now and then. They went to the strip club. I did go with them, obviously.
Blimey, my Spanish teacher never said that to me. Good for you.
Were you studying Spanish there then?
Yeah, I was. I did study some Spanish.
And, yeah. So and I went to the strip club, and it was quite an experience actually. But it's like a normal thing that they do. It's so weird.
Yes, it's a different. It's a different life. The thing that I mean, this is very interesting. The thing that sort of really struck me about life in LA, daily life, was that the film business pervades everything.
Yes.
Even people who were sort of lawyers working in, you know, departments. Mm-hmm, everyone's sort of got an angle. You know,
yes.
Everyone's looking for a gig.
It's true.
Everyone's sort of, you know, looking over your shoulder to see who else is coming into the restaurant or the cafe, which ultimately became a bit sort of soul-destroying for me. But
I agree. And, yeah. And then, you know, after LA, I came back to Malta, and I was thinking of kind of going back. And then, you know, thinking back, I didn't want to go back to that, I think.
Okay, so it wasn't like, oh, this is it. This is where I want to build my life, my career,
well,
is Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously dream about it, and I still think about it sometimes, you know. But at the end of the day, the quality of life, I think, is it suffers a little bit there if you're there, you know, struggling, or, you know, unless you have that big break and you become... You know, I could see people were struggling, and I didn't like that.
Yeah, I at some point was sharing a house with 7 other people.
Wow.
A very big house in the Hollywood Hills, and most of them were struggling actors.
Yeah.
And when I say struggling actors, they were basically, you know, working cafe tables and restaurants, waiting for auditions, usually for TV commercial spots. Usually, you know how the deal is with auditions. Most of the time, you don't get it. So
exactly.
It was a bit of a thankless existence, really.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go. I did share flats with a lot of, you know, actors as well. So that,
you know, the deal.
Yeah.
So let's circle around a bit to some of the training you had in LA and also in Europe here, London and Brussels. Mm-hmm. Some of these techniques. What were the kind of nuances that you learned about the acting process?
So I like learning about new techniques, you know. So I'm always on the lookout to kind of train and, you know, do things, discover things. When I was in Brussels, I discovered a friend of mine met someone who said, and he was a film director, and he said, you know, there's this course about the Meisner technique. Mm. And I was like, okay, I hadn't heard of the Meisner technique. Here locally, a few people actually know about it, a few people practice it, and I went to this like 1 week workshop with Larry Silverberg, who came over from the US, and I discovered it, and it's great. So basically, it is based on the simple exercise called the repetition exercise, where two actors sit in front of each other on a chair, and they just like say a word that comes to their mind, and they repeat it until there is sort of an impulse to change it. And but it has to be quite organic. Like you have to keep saying the same word without stopping until there is, you actually feel this impulse. So, for example, you're looking at each other into each other's eyes, and you're like, someone bats their eyelid, and you're like, eyelid, 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 eyelid. And then someone like moves the mouth, and it's like, okay, mouth. It's weird. You kind of have to do it. It's really difficult to explain. And
so
then it builds on from there.
It sounds like it's focusing very much on establishing a strong connection between actors. Because I guess one of the... I think you're obviously much more experienced, I think, with film performing than I am. But one of the things that's a challenge, I think, as an actor is you're focused on your lines, learning what you need to say. But, of course, a scene comes to life when it breathes that connection between the people in the scene, right?
That's exactly what it's about. Because then this exercise keeps building and building. And then you end up doing, like, very complicated physical tasks. Like doing a very complicated and huge puzzle while saying your lines, while doing a scene with your scene partner. And you have to keep doing, like, you can't let go of your physical task. Like, once I did the exercise and I actually made a cake while doing my scene.
Okay.
So, you know, I was doing the measuring and the mixing. So
like it's an imaginary cake.
No.
You're actually making
a cake. I was actually making a cake. And someone comes that does knitting, and someone else was cooking something else, someone else was doing this puzzle, someone else was writing a story, you have to find a complicated task while saying, because then the focus kind of shifts from the lines, from the consciousness, like being self-conscious of saying the lines, to the feeling that you create with this person, and then the lines kind of become more like lifelike in a way. Because
to shift away from the idea that you're giving a performance, and rather that you're doing something, you know, every day, but in the context of this dramatic scene, I suppose.
Yeah. So the idea is to kind of go out a little bit from, you know, sort of the thinking of the lines and the self-consciousness, and to let the lines flow and the relationship take over with the, you know, and creating this relationship that you mentioned kind of thing.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, I've done quite a bit of improv here. I don't know if you've got improv in your background as well. There's some connection, I think, with the exercises you're describing. Mm-hmm. Because, again, we're creating organic scenes, but it all comes down to that sort of magic. It's hard to define.
Yes, exactly. Yes, 100%.
Fascinating. All right, well, look, Antonella, we're going to get into some of your examples of your actual work shortly, but before we get to that, today's show is focusing on wartime dramas.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask, do you have a movie in this sort of little subgenre that you're particularly fond of?
Yes, I'm very fond of a film called The English Patient.
They found him in the desert, a man with no name.
I think I was a pilot.
And no country.
Anybody remotely foreign is suddenly a spy.
Fire!
A man they call the English Patient.
Why you set the tower to keep me alive?
Because I'm a nurse.
Now, to unlock the mystery of his past.
Anybody she ever loves tends to die of her.
Ask your saint who he's killed.
So, from 1996, this is Anthony Minghella's multiple Oscar-winning wartime romantic drama, The English Patient. Now, Antonella, I'm going to upset you here. I've got to be honest. I saw this years ago. I was not a big fan of this film.
How can you, Andrew?
Everyone else loves it. So, I'm giving you the opportunity now on national radio. Yeah. Why am I wrong? Why should I think this is one of the great wartime dramas?
Well, I think that it's a hugely poetic film, mm-hmm. and the characters are, you know, sort of... The casting is amazing. I love all the actors' performances. It manages to make me cry and go through all the emotions with the actors. The story is incredible as well. It's kind of divided into two sort of places, timelines,
mm-hmm.
and I just love everything about it. You know, the music is beautiful, the script is beautiful, the actors' performances are very raw, and I love, you know, things like, you know, when the character by Kristen Scott Thomas, like they're mentioning, you know, there's a part here in between the two neck here at the throat, and they're mentioning that part and they're giving it a name. It's very romantic, and I guess it's a huge, amazing love story, and that's part of the reason why I love it.
Yeah, I certainly remember it being a very epic
production,
right? It's got settings in the desert, there's colonial sort of buildings,
mm-hmm,
there's the hospital, the makeshift hospital where the man is recuperating.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a very lavish piece of filmmaking, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything about it is lavish and epic. I think they set out to make an epic movie, and they managed. It's very long, and it's kind of slow in a way. But, you know, obviously the plot is moving along, obviously, all the time. So, like, I tried to watch it again, and I was like, I think, you know, it might have aged, so I tried to watch it, and I said, okay, it's going to be quite slow, you know, now, because we're more used to maybe faster production.
And how did you find it?
And I still loved it, I have to be honest. I watched it recently.
You didn't feel it had aged?
No, I didn't, really. I was really enthralled by it still, like the same way I was, and I cried again, so...
Cool, so a classic for the ages. Maybe it's one that I need to... take another look at.
Maybe. You need to be in the mood, maybe, you know, for like a slow, poetic, romantic film.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. thank you for that very good pitch, actually. I mean, that's sort of got my interest piqued again. Okay, well, thanks, Antonella. So let's move on to some of your work now. Some of your film roles. So the Hallmark Channel is an interesting company. They've chosen Malta for a couple of their recent productions. Mm-hmm. Back in the first episode of season two of the show, the Hallmark Channel shot Mix Up in the Mediterranean. And this year they've come back to Malta to shoot, I believe the title is To Catch a Spy.
Yes.
Which you had a role in. Bree Hammond, I believe, was your character's name?
That's right, yeah.
So, to start with, was that an unusual character for you to be playing compared to some of your past roles? Tell us a bit about your character's personality in the film.
Yeah, so, basically, it was great to be part of this. And the greatest thing about this is that there was sort of half the cast, which were foreign actors, which were came from mostly the US. But then there was a lot of local actors that had very good roles in the movie. That was great because sometimes, you know, the foreign productions that come here only have small roles for the local actors and it's like a couple of lines or, you know, a small appearance. So this was, I thought, an amazing opportunity for local actors to showcase their talents. And there's so much talent here and I wish we had better roles in more movie productions, you know. And my character was Bree Hammond and I was, I played like it's set in a hotel, mm-hmm. basically, the whole plot, and I played the hotel manager, Bree Hammond, and I end up as being one of the main suspects of this murder.
Huh, so it's sort of a murder mystery?
It is a murder mystery, so I think it will actually air on Hallmark Murders and Mysteries. I think that's how the channel is called specifically, because I think they have multiple. It's a murder mystery, and it's interesting, and I loved playing my role, you know. It was great to be part of this big family. Everyone was so friendly on set, you know, the director was really nice. Everyone, the producers, there was a really nice atmosphere. You know, sometimes on sets, there is a little bit of tension, you know. Obviously, the director sets the tone on set, you know. But this was just so nice to be part of. Even the other actors, you know, the foreign ones, the local ones. We kind of became a little bit, you know, friends, obviously. Cool. So, you know, I love the whole experience. And it's going to air on the 20th of June.
Cool, that sounds great. Yeah, I mean, we had Anthony Edridge on the show last week, and he also described his appearance in the previous Hallmark film in a similar way, that it was a nice atmosphere, friendly, very mm-hmm. calm.
Yes.
You know, which speaks well, I think, to the production.
Yes, for sure. I think that's what you need, you know. You want everyone to be working, you know, in a sort of serene way, to be given their space, you know, to let, you know, if you have any questions for the director, you know, there's a good relationship, you know, you feel like you can talk to the director and suggest things as well, and he will, you know, he will discuss, probably say yes, you know. So it was that kind of, you know, atmosphere.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of reviewers sort of refer to Hallmark movies almost in a pejorative sense, like at a global level. But I think that sort of dismisses the efficiency of the system that they've built, because they're probably churning out, I don't know how many of these films a year, but several, right?
Yes.
With probably different crews.
Very efficient.
And different, you know, it's an amazing machine, really, and evidently it's appealing to a wide cross-section of the audience, certainly in the US, but apparently globally as well. So well, we look forward to seeing that movie on the 20th of June for people in Malta here who have access to the murder mystery.
I think it's Hallmark Murders and Mysteries. I think it's something like that. There is a trailer and it's mentioned there.
Great. We look forward to it. Okay, well, so let's talk about some of the more local works. Abigail Malia from Take Two has created a series of shorts. I'm going to try the title here, see if I get it right. La Hartania.
This is the short that I was in, which is part of a series of seven short movies. And these are based on the seven deadly sins.
Okay.
And I think the individual movies have all different titles. And I think the whole project is called Tri Isseba, which means like the seventh street.
Yes.
Seventh street, something like that.
Street number seven.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay, and in terms of tone and theme, obviously it's focusing on these seven deadly sins, but are these shorts taking the form of narrative drama stories? Are they sort of more visual, poetic?
So, yeah, there's definitely a narrative. There's seven different stories, I believe. I don't know a lot about the other six films. Some of them have been filmed. Some of them are still to be filmed. The short that I was in focused on Pride. died. So it was me and another character called Fabio, the actor is called Fabio Mifsud, and it was great. It's a great story, and the seven films, as Abigail was telling me, they're all in different styles as well.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to see how they all come together, and it was great. I had never worked with Abigail and Take Two. You know, there's a great team there as well. They've been working together for a long time. And Carlos de Battista wrote it from Take Two. So I was very happy. I'm always happy to be part of local productions, you know.
Absolutely.
So I'm always looking out for, you know, directors, local directors to work with. That's something that, obviously, here in Malta, we all want to see more indigenous filmmaking, that's for sure. And and this is how you start, you know, to build relationships, you know, to build bridges with filmmakers. So I was very happy to be part of the project.
This is cool. Now, talking about other local directors who are creating shorts in different styles, Maxime Durand was a guest on our show a few episodes ago. And of course, he made his Coming Soon series, which you had the starring role is, I guess, in one of them. If I remember correctly, it was a science fiction short.
That's right.
You're an astronaut on an alien planet.
So I go to the future, where the atmosphere has become very toxic. So I had to wear this sort of gear that looks like an astronaut, you know, so to keep the toxicity away. So I travel to the future and I'm communicating with the past kind of thing, and I'm telling them, you know, things have changed here, you know, and cars, and so it was all about transport, and you know, it was a sort of tongue-in-cheek, obviously, take on you know, the amount of cars that we have here, you know, and it was, Maxime is great, you know, he's an amazing guy, very creative, he can do everything, you know, and it was so much fun to do.
That's great to hear. Moving on, Antonella, we've got so many subjects we could talk about here, but we're running out of time. You've also moved into producing your own shorts now with your first film, Marboot. I'm happy to say it's going to be screened at the July event of Malta Indie Shorts at the Spazio Creative Cinema here in Malta, in Valletta. Tell us a bit about that film. What was the inception of the story?
So basically, as you know, as actors, it's not easy to find good parts. So at some point, I decided that if I want to play a part that I really want to play, I might have to actually create it myself or produce a film myself. So that's where it's sort of came from. But before doing that, I wanted to find a really good story. I wanted to believe in the story, because that's the most important thing, that you believe in the story. And also, you will have to live with this film for a long time, you know. Filmmaking takes a lot of time, takes a lot out of you, so you really have to be in love with what you're doing to be able to put it to an end, you know.
And are you able to pitch us the log line of the story very briefly?
I forgot the log line, but it's basically about a guy who wakes up after his stag night, and he is just tied up and bound and
blindfolded,
and basically he wakes up, he finds his ex there. He doesn't know what she's doing, what he's doing there, and then we have the whole plot that unfolds, and then we discover why he's there, what she's doing there in a wedding dress, and then we get to know why. There's a whole plot, and this was based on a play by my friend Simon Bartolo, and it had been done as a theater many years ago, and I always liked the story, so I took that story and I adapted it for the screen. Then Simon, the playwright himself, got involved, and we kind of developed it together. Then Winston Atsopardi, who is the director of the film, he also got involved, and we discussed, obviously, the screenplay. We changed it, we adapted it. The play was very different, obviously, as you can imagine. But, I mean, the main plot, the main story is there, but a lot of things change. You make it screen-friendly. And then we filmed it, and it's been to many festivals now as well.
Yes.
It's also, you know, it's been some time now, so I want to think about my next movie, you know, maybe produce a short. I would like to maybe start writing something as well. But it takes a lot of time. Like, you really need to sit down and actually, you know.
Indeed.
It's a huge commitment.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, writing is something I'm involved in as well, and it's very easy to say, oh, I'm going to sort of do that one, and then I'm going to knock out that story. But when you actually want to develop something and then, of course, go through the draft process. It's a very time and energy consumptive process, isn't
it? Exactly. So I'm still looking for a story that engages me, and then I'll be ready to spend the time, you know, to develop it, kind of.
Fantastic. Antonella, this has been really interesting. If people listening to the show today want to find out a little bit more about your work, maybe see some examples, is there somewhere online they can go?
Sure, they can go on my website, which is antonellaaccisa.com. So there's like two A's in the middle.
Okay.
That is my website. There's different sections, you know, there's a voiceover section, which is something that I do a lot as well. There's a there's my channel. There's a lot of like short movies that I did. And you can also go on the YouTube channel, which is Accisa One, I think, and you can watch a lot of things there. And there's, you know, I have a showreel, and I have a lot of photos, you know, all the headshots that you send to casting directors and everything. So everything is there, and I have a Facebook page as well, Antonella Accisa Official, I think that's like the name.
Great. So lots of places to find out more about Antonella's interesting work. This is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew.
We wish you all the best, Antonella, and we really hope we'll be seeing more of your work on the theatre stage and on the big screen here in Malta very soon.
Thank you.
Now then, what about wartime drama features going off with a bang that were shot here in Malta? One movie was set during World War II. An odd assortment of military experts teamed up on a mission to raid and destroy a bridge that's vital to enemy strategy.
Get out! Force 10 from Navarone, directed by Guy Hamilton, who propelled James Bond through Goldfinger and Live and Let Die.
There's no bridge in the world that can't be blown. That's what Force 10 was here to prove.
They're lying. Kill them.
Well, as you heard from 1978, this is the action war drama Force 10 from Navarone. Not officially billed as a sequel to the classic war movie The Guns of Navarone, there are nonetheless common story elements used here. There's an all-star cast, including a very young Harrison Ford and Robert Shaw. Yes, that salty sailor from Spielberg's 1975 classic Jaws. And here in Force 10, Shaw sadly gave one of his last performances before he died. Shot in the UK and various former Yugoslavian territories, the movie, like so many others, also used the water tanks here at the Malta Film Studios. Force 10 got pretty mixed reviews, it has to be said. Director Guy Hamilton, who, as you may have heard in the trailer, helmed some big James Bond movies, was apparently somewhat on autopilot mode here. But the film does seem to feature some big special effects set pieces, so Force 10 from Navarone should make for some pretty solid, if dated, war drama.
Right here.
This Christmas, there will be only one motion picture with the force of Alastair MacLean's Force 10 from Navarone. The high adventure that blows the dam on excitement.
Let's have a little musical interlude now from one of the films we'll discuss a little bit later on in the show. This theme is composed by Anne Dudley.
Thank you.
Well, let's now venture beyond Malta to discover wartime dramas that really go off with a bang. And we start off with the biographical story of Ron Kovic, an idealistic young American who dreams of being a great soldier.
13,000 miles. It's a long way to go to fight a war.
Don't you know what it means to me to be a Marine, Dad? Ever since I was a kid, I've wanted this. I wanted to serve my country. I want to go to Vietnam. I'll die there if I have to.
There's something happening in here.
You gotta try and stay alive, okay? You hear me? Ain't exactly
clear. From 1989, this is Oliver Stone's towering war drama, Born on the 4th of July, starring Tom Cruise. It's adapted from the autobiography by Ron Kovic, who also gets a screenwriting credit along with the director. Well, Oliver Stone was a pioneering independent voice in late 20th century cinema. In 1986, he directed Platoon, another celebrated war movie. In 91, there was JFK, about the events surrounding the early 60s assassination of US President John F. Kennedy. Well, in 2020, Stone gave an extended interview to the BBC's Arts Hour program. It's available online as a podcast, and I honestly can't recommend it highly enough. A fascinating listen. Back to Born on the 4th of July, then, Kovic soon volunteers for active duty in Vietnam. The film harrowingly depicts the fog of war, and, as you might expect, it doesn't end well for young Kovic, played, of course, by Tom Cruise. Well, in our previous episode, Dramas with a Genre Spin, we discussed First Blood, Sylvester Stallone's action drama. That movie did grapple with the psychological effects of war, but it's hard to imagine a more somber study of the devastating after-effects of military conflict than we see here in Oliver Stone's drama. Kovic survives massive injuries, eventually being brought back to his American hometown of Massapequa, where he reunites with his family. This is one of the most powerful homecomings you'll ever see rendered on film. I challenge you to come out of this without a broken heart. Let's just have a listen to the start of this scene.
Yeah, it's really great to be back in the neighborhood. You know, I got it. Everything looks so different. Major.
Hey.
Hey, Major. Yeah.
Major.
Oh, boy.
This is.
Yeah.
Come
on, old man. I know, huh?
Yeah, just like your old
good
man.
Boy.
Ronnie.
Hey, Tommy.
Good. Look at that hair, Dad. You let him look like that?
I don't have too much to say about it anymore.
How you doing, Jimmy?
Hey, it's good to have you home.
Yeah, it's good to be home.
Are you out for good?
Yeah, I'm out for good.
Well, a great deal has been written about Tom Cruise over the years. Back in episode 7 of season 1 of our show, we discussed his role in the crime drama The Firm. Well, if any of our listeners ever doubted his talent as an actor, those fears will forever evaporate with Born on the 4th. Cruise is astonishing in the lead role, but he also has such strong support. Oliver Stone assembles a tremendous ensemble cast, demonstrating his true mastery at extracting the right tonal interactions between his performers. Here's the moment Kovic sees his mom again for the first time on his homecoming.
Ronnie!
Mom!
Ronnie!
Hey, Mom. Oh, look at your hair. It's great.
I like it.
Oh, you look beautiful.
Face.
It's good to be home. It's better to see me in that hospital, eh? It's okay.
I know.
I'm okay. Yeah? Okay.
It's good to have you home, Ronnie.
Gee, everybody looks so good. Everybody looks so good.
I'm going to go outside for a minute.
Mom, wait.
Should be okay.
Hey, Ronnie. How are you, man? You look good. You look good.
Yeah, good, Ronnie. You look great. Ronnie, welcome home. You look so good to see you. Look at Harry. Welcome home, Ronnie. That scene is so notable for the restraint shown all round as everyone meets Ronnie again in the garden in front of the whole neighborhood and indeed community. But the film has no plan on stopping there. We get an absolutely crushing look at life inside the home once the initial pleasantries have all worn off and the inevitable truth about Ronnie's new life becomes clear.
What's going on? Are you drunk again?
Hey, Mom.
He's drunk again. Eli, we have a drunk for a son. Leave that alone. You can't stay in this house.
This is what you believe in, isn't it, Mom? This is what you believe in, but I don't.
I can't stay in this house.
I don't believe in him anymore.
Go to bed, honey.
Because
he only
had to spend 3 days up there. Me, I got to spend the rest of my life. I wish I were dead like him.
You don't know what you're saying.
That's the problem, Mom. I'm not dead. I got to live. I got to live and I got to roll around. I got to remind him of Vietnam. And you don't want to know. You don't want to see us. You want to hide us. You want to hide us because it is a can of... And I am a... Dummy!
He won't listen. He won't change.
Ronnie, please. You gotta take your mom seriously. You can't drink in this house.
They told us.
Go fight! Go kill! Sergeant man, rain car! Let's go left! Go left! Go left!
It's all lie, old thing.
Watch out!
Ronnie!
Why? Stop it! Go to bed. You sleep it off.
What did they do to you in that war? What happened to you? You need help, Ronnie. You need help.
You need help! With all your God and your dreams about
gonna
me!
Wake up the whole thing.
You are ashamed of me! You're embarrassed by me!
No, you just give us a minute. Let me talk to him, all right?
You go to bed, Harry.
Yo!
Don't
what did you say to me?
Superb drama, though it is a difficult watch. Note that this movie includes some very strong language, which we've edited as appropriate in these clips here. The film is arguably Oliver Stone's strongest anti-war statement.
Ronnie, that's enough! Wake them up! Tell them! Cusacks! Carmelites! Walters! You tell them all! Tell them all what they did to me!
Ronnie, stop it!
It's over 30 years old now, and Cruise is still going strong. Arguably, he's into lighter blockbuster fare these days. But to discover some of his most serious work, Born on the 4th of July is an absolute must. We shift tone quite markedly now, yet it's for a study of war that's no less profound. Indeed, this next film is far more mystical, nay, spiritual even.
In this world, a man himself is nothing. And there ain't no world but this one.
I see another world. Sometimes I think it was just my imagination.
If I go first, I'll wait for you there.
on the other side of the dark waters. Why should I be afraid to die? I belong to you.
We move to the World War II Pacific Theatre of War on Guadalcanal. That's one of the Solomon Islands, close to Papua New Guinea, for Terrence Malick's 1998 war drama, The Thin Red Line. Now, the narrative here, and so far as one exists, focuses on an incursion by US troops deep into the island to face an almost ephemeral Japanese military threat.
Get up that hill there.
How many men do you think it's worth? How many lives?
There's nowhere we can hide, except in each other.
Go! Go!
I killed a man. Worst thing you could do. Nobody could touch me for it.
Makes no difference who you are. No matter how much training you got, how tough a guy you might be, you're in the wrong spot at the wrong time, you're gonna get it.
But The Thin Red Line is quite unique as war movies go. Rather than a straight depiction of the horrors of war itself, that imagery instead forms a backdrop to the much more prominent thematic thrust of the piece. It's essentially a philosophical rumination on the meaning of life. Yes, you heard me right, and this might sound like an odd mix. Indeed, the film was somewhat ill-received by more than a few critics upon release. Several commentators felt that the rather artsy ruminations didn't jive with the stark events taking place. I humbly disagree. For me, this is one of the most meditative pieces of cinema I can remember seeing. Consider one soldier who trudges through the jungle, mentally composing letters to his spouse back home, perhaps as an escape from the horrors affronting his eyes.
My dear wife, you get something twisted out of your insides by all this blood, filth, and noise. I want to stay changeless for you. I want to come back to you the man I was before. How do we get to those other shores? To those blue hills?
There's a towering visual aesthetic at work throughout this film, underlining the profound spiritual rumination that it most surely is. The depictions of battle are world-class, easily on a par with the best war films made to date. Yet the movie is suffused with artfully framed shots of flora and fauna from this dense, verdant jungle and the surrounding seas. The photography is absolutely breathtaking. Light, in particular, is stunningly used in the nature shots. Flashbacks are repeatedly employed, often in slow motion, to underline the narration. It's lyrically effective. And the musical soundtrack, which feels like it just doesn't stop for the entire film's runtime, is a masterful piece of tonal scoring. Consider another sequence here, where the terrorized countenances of newly captured prisoners of war accompany this ominous voiceover, one of several in the movie.
This great evil. Where's it come from? How'd it steal into the world? What seed, what root did it grow from? Who's doing this? Who's killing us? Robbing us of life and light.
But don't think that this is a film without drama, without relationships, without a story, because it absolutely is. Jim Caviezel is arguably our protagonist here. He uses his luminous, otherworldly blue-gray eyes to fantastic effect. Particularly resonant is his combative relationship with his superior officer, played by Sean Penn, who, of course, we've mentioned more than once in previous episodes of our show. those two characters have several key sequences which powerfully portray the evolution of their friendship during this harrowing war. And in an early scene, Caviezel, who's initially AWOL, that is, absent without leave, on a remote island, cavorts with the natives and ruminates on his existence in a sequence that's really emblematic of what this film is all about.
I remember my mother when she was dying. Looked all shrunk up and gray. I asked her if she was afraid. She just shook her head. I was afraid to touch the death I seen in her. I couldn't find nothing beautiful or uplifting about her going back to God. I heard people talk about immortality, but I ain't seen it. Died. What it'd be like to know that this breath now was the last one you was ever going to draw. I just hope I can meet it the same way she did, with the same calm. 'Cause that's where it's hidden, the immortality I hadn't seen.
Beautiful sound design and music, as I think you'll agree. Another joy of the film is the cast. You'll recognize countless famous actors from this era. Nick Nolte is incandescent as an aging general hell-bent on achieving his lifelong military dreams. But there's also John Travolta, Adrian Brody, Woody Harrelson, John Cusack, Elias Koteas, who gives a particularly moving performance. It's almost like everyone who wasn't in Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, which was made in the same year, was cast in this movie, haha. A very different beast to Spielberg's undeniably stunning rendition of War. The Thin Red Line is, I'd argue, Malick's own masterpiece. It even eclipses his more recent 2011 fantasy drama, Tree of Life, starring Brad Pitt. Cut from a very different cloth also to the aforementioned and more conventional Born on the 4th of July, you really must add The Thin Red Line to your war movie collection.
What difference do you think you can make, one single man, in all this madness?
You're just too soft-hearted. You're not tough-fibered enough.
Have you ever had anyone die in your arms, sir?
Who lit this flame in us? Because I have you, nothing can touch me. No hurt, no grief, not even death.
We shift tone, and indeed war period, once again for our next film. A love affair between the second in line to Britain's throne and the princess of the feuding Irish spells doom for the young lovers.
I want him to grow old in a land where all of us are at peace.
Take all your men, guard the women.
Please go and hurry! Who's this?
Tristan. Where's
his
family now?
He's got the heart of a lion. Just needs some time.
Ever since you were a boy, you've sacrificed everything for me.
From 2006, this is Tristan and Isolde, and we played the theme from this film's original soundtrack recording a little earlier on in today's show. The movie adapts the 12th century wartime love story, which was immortalized, of course, in Richard Wagner's epic 1865 opera of the same name. In this film version, direction is by Kevin Reynolds, local film aficionados might recognize his name, Reynolds came to Malta in 2002 to direct The Count of Monte Cristo, starring Guy Pearce and, once again, Jim Caviezel. Reynolds even came back to Malta again in 2016 to direct the biblical drama Risen. And, well, Reynolds has had a tough run with the movie critics over the years. The Kevin Costner vehicle Waterworld springs to mind here. And his medieval war romance here proved no real exception to that rule. Perhaps it was compared unfavorably with Mel Gibson's epic 1995 movie Braveheart, which arguably hits a lot of the same thematic beats. That said, I found Tristan and Isolde to be an absorbing and well-made drama.
Did I love him like a son, or did I misuse him for my own purposes?
He's alive!
You're safe here. Just sleep.
What's your name?
Oh, I think it's better we don't bother with names. Don't you think there's more to life? Why long for things if they're not meant to be ours?
James Franco takes the lead, arguably overcooking his moody romantic gambit a little bit, but it all works as he's in good acting company with solid support from Rufus Sewell and Mark Strong, amongst others. Particularly impressive is Sophia Miles as the joint romantic lead, with an incredibly sincere and moving turn. She portrays the woman Tristan falls in love with, but who tragically hails from the other side of both sea and clan.
What's this about a tournament?
He's offered his daughter
to whichever a tribe wins.
Let me go and win you a wife.
I'm yours.
No. Tristan has won you on behalf of Lord Mark.
Your marriage will end 100 years of bloodshed.
I'm married to another man. I'll pretend it's you.
Lest we forget, this romance does take place against the backdrop of war. The battle scenes are perfectly well staged and rendered, too. There's good photography, lighting, and medieval production design. Narratively, it does perhaps hit some rather conventional twists and turns, but as an impossible love yarn, it's unexpectedly poignant. In particular, there's a beautiful music soundtrack accompanying the film's more touching and sometimes poetic moments.
My face in thine eyes, thine and mine appears, and true plain hearts do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres, without sharp north, without declining west? Whatever dies was not mixed equally. If our two loves be one, and thou and I love so alike, that none can slacken, none can die.
Crikey, this has all been a bit heavy today, hasn't it? So let's jolly things up a little bit, shall we? Finally then, we move right up to 2019 for a film that's arguably unintroducible. This is Taika Waititi's comedy war drama, Jojo Rabbit.
You know what I am?
What's it?
A Jew. Gesundheit.
Sheesh, that was intense.
What am I going to do?
No idea.
Got it! I
will
negotiate.
Burn down the house and blame Winston Churchill. We'll negotiate.
If I tell on you, you'll be in big trouble.
You'll never win.
Love is the strongest thing in the world.
Your mother took me in. She's kind. She treats me like a person.
You two seem to be getting on well.
She doesn't seem like a bad person.
Look, people, I'll be honest with you. From this film's trailer, I thoroughly expected to hate it. But fan of genre comedy that I am, since critical reception of word of mouth was so strong, I couldn't ignore. And boy was I ever wrong. The eponymous Jojo, an army boy in World War II Germany, has an unusual imaginary friend of the most implausible identity.
Hey, Jojo, my old friend.
Hi, Adolf.
What's wrong, little man?
They call me a scared rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit!
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's going to get us all killed.
I know what you're thinking. Pure madness. Yes, that's right. This kid's conjured up Hitler as his imaginary buddy. The first act of the film is rife with physical and verbal comedy. More than once, I found myself questioning the good taste of such an endeavour, taking on, as it does, such sensitive and serious historical subject matter. Even the German Gestapo and army personnel are ruthlessly lampooned.
Hey, Jean-Jacques! Hey, guys! Good to see you. My bicycle got a flat tire, so I carried it.
Captain Tenzendorf. Oh, Hitler.
Hi, 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 Hitler. You know, Freddy Finkel.
Hi, Hitler.
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 So, did I miss anything?
No, no, we were just Heil Hitlering the boy, and then Heil Hitlering yourself, and then, of course, Heil Hitlering Freddy Finkel, and now we're in the midst of a routine inspection.
Let's be absolutely honest, none of this should work, and yet it totally does. Waititi himself, as Adolf Hitler, is ludicrously trite, but also very funny. Does it always work? Probably not, but what a gamble, eh? There's a terrific cast, and a very impressive lead role from child actor Roman Griffin Davis as Jojo. Here, he argues with his mother.
Why does that make you happy? You hate your country that much?
I love my country. It's a war I hate. It's pointless and stupid, and the sooner we have peace, the better.
Oh, the war will end. We will crush our enemies into dust, and when they are destroyed, we shall use their graves as toilets.
Okay, no more politics. Dinner is neutral ground. This table is Switzerland. Let's eat.
There's a moment when things turn much more somber and serious for our young protagonist. You'll know it when you see it. No spoilers, though. You really need to go into this one cold. There's a terrific turn from the always engaging Sam Rockwell. He's just dynamite in this film, and not just because of his innate comedic talents.
Okay.
Hey, it's okay, kid. I've been meaning to tell you, I think your book is really great. Yeah, I'm sorry for laughing at it.
Very creative.
Come here, let's take a look at you.
You look good. You're okay, kid. Now go home, look after that sister of yours. Okay?
Get away. Get away, Jew.
Hey!
Get away!
What's going on?
The Jew!
Shut up. You know this Nazi?
No, I don't know this dirty Jew.
No, no.
Get away, Jew.
Shopping mall Nazi.
The story builds to a beautifully staged and deeply moving climax. This really is a very poignant piece of modern satire. Utterly wackadoodle, patently absurd in concept, but an ultimately masterful entry in the wartime drama canon. Let's have a listen to the lovely soundtrack accompanying some of those final scenes of Jojo Rabbit.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed the selection today. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thanks to our guest, Antonella Axisa, for joining us, and of course to our sound engineer, Jordi De Bono. The intro was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io, and those clips are licensed under creativecommons.org version 4. Thanks for listening, and do tune in next week for another episode of More Than a Movie.